Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
I would go out with the starters, long toss with them, do their stretching, do their whole routine, come back in, do flat ground, and then join the reliever stretch, you know, an hour later, and then do the same thing again from the other side.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Banduho. Today, I'm talking to MLB's first ever switch pitcher, Pat Vendetti. We're obviously going to talk a lot about switch pitching and Pat's journey from a college walk-on at Creighton with a unique skill to a guy who developed both arms to big league quality, debuting with the A's in 2015. He breaks down the extra work that went into that, how he decided which side to use against switch hitters, and how he always picked the team he signed with during minor league free agency. Really, really unique episode. I loved hearing Pat walk through all the nuances of how he worked his left side, how he worked his right side. Really glad he stopped by the show. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. We are into the college baseball postseason, my favorite time of the year. Also covering minor league baseball. The prospect hot sheet is going. Always a good time to subscribe to Baseball America. And with that, let's talk to Pat Vendetti. All right, joining in for today's episode from Phenom on the Farm, he's the 14th overall pick of the 06 draft, former big league outfielder Travis Snyder. Travis, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. I want to dive in first off to give you a chance to talk about what you're doing with 3A Athletics. I saw there was a recent piece on you in The Athletic, which I thought was excellent, and kind of went into what you're doing now with your focus on improving youth baseball, which is a passion of mine. So would love to hear about it off the top.
Yeah, when I retired and going into my retirement, I was struggling with the identity crisis of being a baseball player my entire life and then transitioning into the real world, right? And having signed out of high school at 18, it's all I knew. And I had developed other skills outside of just being a baseball player, but so much of my self-worth and value was derived from being a baseball player. So as I'm going through this process, I started working with a therapeutic life coach who is now my partner and the author of the books for 3A Athletics. His name is Seth Taylor. And Seth has worked with Major League Soccer players as well as Major League Baseball players and anyone from a high-level CEO down to your average sports parent and youth players in youth baseball. So in working with Seth, I was able to understand how much of this stemmed from my childhood experiences of playing baseball and having success and then becoming a first round pick and then all the ups and downs through my career that have been well documented. But emotionally and mentally, I wasn't able to make that connection as a player. I worked with a lot of great sports psychologists and quickly realized that I had a lot that I was dealing with on the mental emotional side, but didn't really understand the root cause. So as I retired and was working with Seth, I realized he had written a book for parents in youth soccer that is focused on the parent-child relationship, the parent-coach relationship, and then the parent relationship with the team or the club that you're involved in. And as I read the book, I realized this was, number one, easily transferable for multiple sports. So that's where baseball and softball are now on the menu for us as far as what's available. And we look to get into other sports like football, basketball, tennis, wrestling, et cetera, hockey as we get further along. But ultimately, the whole goal of 3A Athletics is to improve the culture of youth sports, change it really from what it's become to what me and my partners feel, you know, very convicted as far as where we've missed opportunities to help mentor our young children who are playing these sports on through their high school careers and into college and into professional baseball, and seeing this pattern with teammates that I played with at the major league level or the minor league level, or some of my best friends of 20, 30 years that I grew up playing little league baseball all the way through high school baseball, is that transition is really difficult. And a lot of us that had success throughout our careers, or maybe didn't have the success we thought we were going to have, deal and struggle with that as you're transitioning out of playing sports. And I think that conversation around mental health has become much more in the forefront, but for us, we feel like there's a lot of opportunity to not only provide the products that we have available with our parent guidebook Hero and the From Good to Great Athletes Journal, but from a podcast to more content to more products and services that we can provide to the world of youth sports for parents to have a better understanding of what the experience is that they're going through and how to better manage that. For coaches, we have a Coach's Revolution book that will be coming out this year that is focused on the same concepts as the parent guidebook, developing a healthy relationship with the sport and the kids that you're coaching, and understanding where your past experiences can positively and negatively affect you, the way that you coach and respond in certain situations that are really opportunities for us to teach our kids how to deal with failure or a bad umpire or a parent who's, you know, acting out of line. And then just looking at the world of youth sports as a whole, you have a lot of great coaches who are burnt out on parent drama. You have a lot of parents who are burnt out on, you know, the youth baseball organizations that are pushing certain narratives. And then you have the kids, right, who are the most important people in this whole conversation that are getting tugged, you know, in all different directions by people's expectations and opinions without the realization of where we're at in the childhood development process. So again, that's a long-winded way of saying we have a very large goal of impacting the world of youth sports, the culture of youth sports, by providing parents and coaches and players with products and services that will help them get a better understanding of what they're going through, how to deal with it mentally and emotionally, and how that can lead to better performance on the field, but more importantly, a healthier identity, right? Formation throughout this process of playing sports. Because any one of us that played sports at any level can say, oh yeah, I played for high school or college or pro. But what is it besides that, that we take a lot of pride in and value ourselves as a human being outside of just being an athlete?
Yeah. And coaching Little League, I know I tell parents, like, even if your child is the top 0.0001% of athlete who plays out a career where financially they're not going to need to do anything after they retire, they're still going to need to be a person and have something for more. They're going to spend more of their life not playing sports and playing sports. So it's about how you build as a person. I would encourage anyone who listened to our series from late last year on sports parenting, was interested in that, go check that stuff out. And that obviously drew me to wanting to interview you and talk about your career, because I think that relationship, you know, is a big factor in your journey. And I want to go back to you, your upbringing, your amateur days. I often sometimes, you know, I'll start the show asking, when did you realize you had a future at the next level? And reading everything about you, was there ever a time, can you remember a time where you didn't think you were going to have a future at some next level of baseball, whether that be professionally or Division I?
I can't say that there was a moment in my youth career where I really questioned it. I think I had surgery on my ankle after my sophomore summer, or during my sophomore summer, which was a pretty big platform year for me on the national kind of showcase experience. I was supposed to go to the Area Code Games and go down there and have a chance to show out in front of scouts and college recruiters. But I was able to get through that summer, rehab the injury, missed my junior year of football because of my injury. And then going into my senior year, that's when that junior summer is such a pivotal one for kids, right? Out on that whole circuit, playing in showcases and playing in front of scouts. And my draft status had really shot up over the course of my junior year and put me in a position to have to make that decision not to play football anymore. So it's kind of like, okay, my football career is done, but I'm going all in on baseball. And going through that process, there was never really a doubt in my mind that I was going to play professional baseball. I think once I got into professional baseball, I had a ton of success, right? As a 18-year-old in rookie ball, I won the MVP. And then I went to low A the next year and was a top three candidate for the MVP and put up great numbers. I went to the Arizona Fall League, was one of the best players in the Fall League amongst a huge talent group of big prospects. And then I went back into the farm system and kind of shot my way through the next year in 2008 with the expectation I was going back to the fall league and then was playing in the big leagues. And I struggled for a few weeks, about a month in double A that year, where me and my old teammate Ricky Romero had some heart-to-heart conversations about the idea of being first-round picks and being a bust and how are we going to kind of get through this struggle point in our careers. And Ricky had been there
flat
for a couple
bill
years.
Legend Ricky Romero.
Oh, yeah. So Ricky and I became very close throughout our careers and shared a lot of these experiences together. But we were able to overcome it, right? Both of us went up in 2008, and then he went up in 2009, and we got to play together in the major leagues. But for me, after the 2008 season of getting to the big leagues, having success in the month of September, and then starting off really hot in April of 2009 as my full rookie year, I thought the sky was the limit, right? And that's what I talk about, the ego and the narratives that started to become kind of my motivation instead of like my internal compass and my identity of who I am and what I bring to the sport of baseball. It became very much about what I do on the field. It's going to dictate the way people view me and how I received that love. And as I started to struggle in May of 2009, that's when the doubts really started to creep in. I got sent down shortly after that and never really recovered mentally and emotionally from that. I did battle back and, you know, stored throughout my career going up and down and kind of showing the grit to get back to from AAA to the major leagues and bounced around, got traded, and just kind of went through a whole roller coaster of experiences throughout my career. And it was really tough for me to maintain that level of confidence and more importantly, maintain that self-love, right, of who I am versus what I do. And that's what makes me a great person versus going out and having a 4-for-4 game and getting on Twitter and seeing, 50,000 people that are just showing you all kinds of love. And then, you know, you go through a tough stretch and you get on Twitter and it's not as fun to read those comments.
Well, in that timeline of sky is the limit that you laid out, really started like how you laid that out starts at like 14, 15, you know, it's a sick over half a decade of, you know, being told like, or feeling like nothing's really going to stop you from when you're pegged as like the next thing from that early of an age, like early in high school. Baseball changes and like amateur sports change in terms of like, you're not just like playing your travel ball games, your high school games. It's this constant evaluation and rankings and stuff like that. How did the feeling of realizing you're being watched constantly, evaluated constantly, affect you at that point? Because that becomes, if baseball is going to be your thing in your career, that becomes the name of the game. Like all the guys playing in the big leagues right now are being evaluated by some sort of scouting department or whatever as far as their value. Like, what did that do to your relationship to just playing a game?
Yeah, I think anytime, you know, money gets involved, the idea of play versus work becomes a very serious conversation. And to your point, there's no shortage of analytics, especially in the current world we live in. But even back then, you always feel like you're kind of split into the person and the baseball player. And for me, I had great mentorship through high school, despite some of the personal struggles we were going through as a family. I had people within the community who really rallied to support me and a couple of very close mentors still to this day that, you know, would take me to dinner weekly or monthly and walk through kind of the college recruiting process, the draft process, how to talk to scouts. So I was very fortunate to have those people in my life to keep me grounded and educated on what the process looks like and what kind of decisions I was going to have to make. But more importantly, to your point, being evaluated in everything you do, whether it's the way you get out of the car when you show up to the field, what's your uniform, how your cleats look, what your face looks like, you know, because I had an old school mentor who was, you know, shave your face, shave your hair, don't have all the eccentric qualities, just be a baseball player, right? And that's something that I really took to heart, especially early in my career. And then, you know, you search for that individuality, I think, that is more common now and maybe to a fault in certain situations, but was entering a space of professional baseball with a pretty clear understanding of how to go about my business, but still being an 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old kid, I made tons of mistakes, even through 31, right, in my career. I was making poor decisions at the end of my career where I realized, okay, I'm not really bought into the idea of what it takes to be great at what I want to do. And that's part of the reason why I retired. But being able to look back on it and evaluate, did a lot of good things along the way, had a lot of great mentorship, but it becomes a very difficult space to be when you are yielded or hailed as one of these top prospects in baseball, and then you struggle. And it's like, well, are all the things that people told me or said about me not true? Am I really not as good as I think I am? When really those weren't the thoughts that were driving my motivation early in my career. And I think that's something for parents to understand, whether your kid is playing college, professional, high school, little league. We start to create expectations, right? When just by sitting and watching them, our body language, the energy that we bring, the conversations we have with them in the car before and after the game, and what we say to them during the game, right? And these are all things that we really try and highlight in our product, Hero, the parent guidebook, is helping parents become more aware of how delicate some of these environments and situations that we're just throwing kids into, and expecting them to handle adversity and expecting them to learn these life lessons that are incredibly important without realizing where they're in the developmental process and what they're really capable of handling. And that's something that I speak on often, is just the age at which things have become so competitive, and with the state and player rankings and all that, it creates these external expectations that 11, 12, 13 year old kids just aren't capable of handling. And to be honest, the parents aren't really capable of handling either, right? Because it's so early in the process. I don't fault any parent for getting excited because their kid's really good at a sport and they love playing it, but it's a really tough journey for parents to maintain that sturdy space, holding that space for the kids to be able to go out there and experience the things and just be a constant source of support and unconditional love, because it's very easy to get wrapped up into tournament wins and losses and where you're ranked and having a couple of bad games. And what does that do for your future? You know what I mean? Those are all things that parents, coaches, and players are dealing with. And that's a lot. And I think that's something that we overlook the opportunity to speak more. And that's kind of the mission of 3A, is to really build a conversation around that and help provide the support for parents, coaches, and players that are going through it.
I want to talk about your experience in the 06 draft. And you mentioned briefly just now kind of dealing with some instability in your personal life and your upbringing in high school. You went into greater detail that in the article in The Athletic, which I would encourage people to check out. With the draft, you know, it's an exciting thing. You're pegged as you're a surefire first round pick, so you know that going in. It's kind of seeing where the chips fall. We see it more in the other major sports because the money's bigger, but sometimes like the draft does lead to 18 or 21 year old kids becoming, if not the breadwinner, at least like the dominant financial figure in their household. As numbers like that are getting thrown around and you're figuring out where the chips might fall, like what was it an exciting process for you, or you know, were there stresses involved beyond just, hey, what team am I going to end up with?
Yeah, I think anytime you hand a kid at 18 or 21 a significant amount of money, depending on what their family structure and upbringing is, what their parents' financial situation is, there's a lot of variables, right? That you can't say this is how it works for everybody. But in my case, I had, you know, two parents who were very loving and supportive parents throughout my career, but struggled with their own personal addictions and demons that I've talked about in other articles. That one in The Athletic goes pretty deep. And I think I wanted to share those things for parents to understand, even if you're not an addict or you're not dealing with these demons in the way that my parents were, there's still a ton of things that your kids are noticing, right, as they're getting older. And being able to build a relationship that's the foundation is trust and safety for kids to be able to come and have those conversations. I was really forced to grow up at a young age, which has its benefits, right, for being able to leave the house at 18 and go out and survive in the world. But at the same time, there's certain parts of my childhood that I didn't really get to experience, right? And growing up in a household that had a lot of instability, especially into my high school years with my mom getting sick and my parents are getting separated and all the things that were happening, baseball was that safe space for me. And I think that was something that was kind of overlooked in the process for me, is that if I have all my eggs in this one basket, if something, you know, like getting sent down from the major leagues is kind of that inflection point where I really first time I realized baseball is not that safe. And now I'm in a space where being a professional athlete that has a lot of expectations around them, you have to go out and perform, right? To keep your job and keep your spot on a roster. And those are all realities of the world that we want our kids to learn and be prepared for. And I think the way the hype and, you know, our economic situation as a family You hear this a lot, right? Athletes just want to sign the big contract, buy their mom or dad a house, which I bought my mom a condo that I live with her in, and be able to support your parents for all the hard work that they put in to get to where you wanted to go. Now, that all sounds good in theory, but there's a lot of pressure, right, consciously and subconsciously, that gets put on an 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old kid to be able to go out there and make millions of dollars to then be able to support the ever-growing family of people who will come in asking for money and you know, investment opportunities. The list goes on as far as bad financial decisions that can be put in front of a kid who, unless they have a great financial advisor, which I did have a really, really good financial advisor all the way through my career to help kind of guard me from some of these poor choices. But that doesn't mean I still didn't go out and spend money on things that, you know, looking back on it, I would have done it differently with the knowledge and experience that I have now. But that being said, there was a lot of pressure because the hype just continued to grow and grow. And I was not in a place, foundationally speaking, with my identity where I was ready to handle baseball providing me the adversity that it did. And I fought the best that I could. And that's something I'm incredibly proud of about my career, even though I didn't live up to my own and the external expectations. I've been able to process that through my own therapeutic process, right, to really make sense of where things went wrong, where I was kind of set up for failure, where I self-sabotaged, and how the mental emotional piece really took a toll on my physical abilities just to go out there and play the game and hit the baseball, which is why I got drafted. It was something that I struggled with a lot throughout my career. And it's, again, something I put in a lot of hard work to overcome these things and get back to where I wanted to get to. But ultimately, I had to walk away from the game and do a lot of soul searching and discovery work as to where things along my childhood path and as an adult didn't go the way that I wanted them to, and how those were still affecting me in my daily life when I interact with my parents, or not my parents, with my kids, with my wife, with my friends, and just the community around me. It was a lot to unpack, and there's still a lot of work to be done. But again, it's something our goal at 3A is to like get to parents, coaches, and players before they get down this road, right? And help prepare them for that inevitable transition that we all go through as athletes, is your last day of playing, and then who are you after you're done?
You mentioned earlier that you hit from pretty much the get-go in pro ball, and I always want to harp on it when there is a guy who played in short season, because it drives me absolutely insane that MLB cut out the short season leagues. And you signed and got 54 games in the Appy League, that experience of going to a different town, playing in front of a crowd, things like that, things that don't come with playing in the complex. You know, and I'll ask you, as someone who then went and replicated that success in full season ball in low A, which is, you know, typically now the jumping off point for a high school first round pick, did you view like you got something out of short season that you wouldn't have gotten out of the complex, or you might have struggled with more if you had been expected to do 90 games in the Midwest League or 100 games in the Midwest League without getting that kind of small sample size right after graduating?
Yeah, I think playing a shorter season has a lot of advantages, especially for high school kids who haven't played 50, 60 game seasons in high school. I know, you know, summer ball, we would play more than that, but being away from home is a big, big factor. Being in front of fans is something that you don't, like you mentioned, you don't really get that in the complex experience. I've rehabbed enough in the complexes over my career where I played a lot of these extended spring training and these kind of now newer aged rookie ball type scenarios. And it's a completely different energy. It's a completely different vibe, for better or for worse. I think there's pros and cons to it. And there's reasons why the organizations as a whole decided that they were going to cut minor league teams. And, you know, there's financial aspects to it. So I don't think there's just one clear cut way of saying it's right or wrong. But I do think there was a lot of value for me having to go away from home and having to play in front of fans and having to deal with some of the chirping that I was getting as a first rounder playing in Pulaski, Virginia. You know, we had our own fan, come on, big money, show me that, why they give you that $1.7 million contract. And then those are things, again, that are part of professional sports. You got to learn how to deal with that stuff. And so I was grateful for my experience in the Appy League, as kind of desolate and far out as some of these towns were, coming from not a huge city myself, but never really spending time on the Eastern coast-ish part of the United States. Again, it was a culture shock, but as we were talking about before we hopped on, it's one of the things I'm most grateful for, that baseball has taken me a lot of different places throughout the United States and Canada, and has given me an opportunity to see the world through other people's lenses and hear different opinions and become somebody who is more understanding and thoughtful when it comes to people who aren't thinking the same way as you, and because of where they're raised and what their beliefs are. And those are all fine. Like, we're all human beings trying to find our way in this world.
Again, like tapping that Athletic article and tapping some of your old BA scouting reports, you were lauded for maturity, leadership, you know, everything you want in the makeup of a guy, which you, you know, have connected to having to grow up a little quicker. With everything in your early minor league career lining up on the baseball field, there are really no setbacks in terms, you know, besides some injury stuff, but on, you know, all your offensive slash numbers are great throughout your, you know, pretty much your entire minor league career. Were there building blocks emotionally or off the field or mentally that, with hindsight being 2020, of things that you could have done different to possibly prepare yourself or be prepared a little more for life in the big leagues, or just life as a, you know, as an adult, you know, as you grow into that? Or is it you kind of are who you are when you get drafted, and it's how things shake out?
I think you are who you are when you're drafted, but you evolve, right? Nobody's the same at, hopefully you're not the same at 25 as you are at 18. So you have a lot more experience under your belt. I think understanding who you look to for leadership, what veteran guys are really on the path to becoming the greatest version of themselves as possible, versus, you know, at every level of sports, you have kids or adults who are just happy to be there, right? And kind of look at the opportunity as like, I made it. And I think that's something I experienced a little bit at the major league level, where we call it the flag planting theory, where it's like, okay, I made it, I'm here, right? And now I don't really know where I'm going from here, because I just kind of checked off this big box. And I talk about having the dreams of being a Hall of Famer and being a middle of the order franchise player, which is kind of where the projections, not Hall of Fame, but the franchise player projections were starting to roll out early in my career. And again, those were all things that I wanted to accomplish, but understanding where I was at in the journey and keeping grounded in the idea that this is a long-term process, instead of getting caught up in all of these short-term successes and failures. And that was something that I really rode, that emotional roller coaster with the ups and downs of my career, the streaks that I had where I was hotter than any hitter in the league, or the streaks where I was one of the worst players in the league. I kind of experienced both ends of the spectrum and just really struggled with the idea of consistency, and being able to go out there with a consistent mindset and emotional state to just play the game and not get so wrapped up in what the organization's thinking about you, what the coaches are thinking about you, what the scouts are thinking about you. Again, as we go back to your previous question of how do you kind of manage that? I think that's where it's difficult to prepare people for that experience that haven't been through it. And I think that there's definitely, you know, groups of people that handle it way better than others. What the secret sauce is behind that, I think, is just grounded in your foundation of who you are and what you bring to the sport that you play, instead of riding and dying with every success and failure that you have.
Again, with the benefit of hindsight, if you're a streaky hitter, now that you think back, like, what were the habits you were taking into the box, or what were the things you were doing when you were having success that you might not have been doing when things weren't falling your way?
I think I relied on superstition, way too much in my career. I mean, I could list off a lot of dumb things that I thought I was doing to have success on the field that had nothing to do with my actual process as developing as a hitter. I was always committed to the work, right, of going to the cage and trying to grind through things when I was struggling and trying to refine my swing or my routine. And I think I got lost a lot in my career trying to chase the perfect swing and trying to appease other people's expectations. Let's say, for example, early in my career, I was a gap-to-gap doubles hitter who hit, you know, I think hit 13 home runs in low A, which wasn't an astronomical number. But, I mean, we had a big gap in right center field, and I think I had 7 or 8 triples as a 245-pound outfielder. So it was like there was some give and take in terms of the power there. And as I went through kind of the next levels of high A, double A, triple A, started to hit more home runs. And again, we're all evolving and trying to become the best version of ourselves. And then I got to the big leagues, and I was really trying to listen to too many people, and with my personality and how my past experiences have kind of molded my personality, I wasn't really aware how easily I would get triggered by coaches, something they would say about my swing or my stance or whatever else. I took that as like a personal attack. I took that as like, you're telling me I don't know what I'm doing. I've hit my way all the way through the minor leagues and was given a lot of grace from the organization as I was rehabbing from injuries, because I told them I got this figured out. And then once I started to believe I didn't have it figured out, it was very difficult for me then to root myself into my process, right? And utilize the coaches that are around, that were around me, that were trying to help me and say, okay, you can coach me, but I have to be the one that's driving this bus. Because ultimately the AAA hitting coach, the A-ball hitting coach that you love isn't going to be there for you later in your career. And if you don't have the understanding of what makes your swing work, what you need to stay focused on in terms of your routine and evolving that routine, but also understanding where you can focus on getting better. And I think we see this with guys in the major leagues that are star players that have one or two really good years, and then the league might adjust to some of their weaknesses. And then they focus so much on their weaknesses that they kind of lose the ability to control what they do really, really well. So I think I battled that a lot in my career, trying to make changes that a lot of times were really emotional, mental triggers that I needed to get through that process so then I could just actually go to the cage and put in the work that I need to put in, leave the work in the cage and go out and compete during the game, and then be able to have a process to evaluate that game work and then be able to, you know, reiterate the things that need to be focused on in practice. And I found it very difficult a lot of times in my career to separate the mechanics, right, in game from what you're working on during the practice sessions and early BPs. And I mean, I took millions of swings in my career, so it wasn't a matter of not working hard. It was a lot of times not working smart and understanding emotionally and mentally if you're in a space, right, where you are completely triggered, for lack of a better term. I know that's a tough term for people to hear, but when you're struggling, right, you see a guy who's in a slump and you can just see the look on their face. It looks like they're defeated before they even step up and take a swing. And I experienced that a lot in my career, looking for mechanics to solve that, right, instead of actually doing the work and reframing the experiences and teaching myself through my own therapeutic process as to who I am, what makes me tick, and what I got to be aware of, right, in terms of how, you know, streaks can affect me positively and negatively, or something a coach says.
I have to ask you about your trip to the Fall League after your first year in the Midwest League. I always love hearing about the Fall League just because it's like, it's dude central. Most everyone there is a prospect, a lot of likely big leaguers, especially on the hitter side. Sometimes they pull pitchers. But with that, you know, with everyone being a dude, was there someone who stuck out to you as, you know, everyone here is good, this guy is that guy?
Evan Longoria was on my team, and I got a chance to play with him until he went to play for Team USA. I think it was the, I don't remember what event they were playing for, but essentially we spent, I think, 3 or 4 weeks during the Fall League together. And we had Max Scherzer on our team and a few other guys that had very, very good base or big league careers. And, you know, being around Evan, he was the prospect, right? And I was a top five or top 10 prospect. Kind of after that experience really showed that I could hang as a 19-year-old with all the 21, 22-year-old guys. But watching Evan go through that process and then playing against him quite a bit early in my career in the AL East, he was definitely a guy that I looked to as like a model, right? A role model as to where I wanted to go and what I wanted to accomplish in my career. And I think, you know, I know Evan hasn't signed and might be retired officially now, but has carved out one heck of a career and was able to achieve a lot of things personally. But then I also know that he was a big part in that Diamondback success last year as a mentor in the clubhouse. So yeah, I mean, being down there at the Fall League, it is a different experience because it's not just your organization. You're now with prospects from all the different organizations. You get coaches from different organizations. And I felt very comfortable down there, even though I was 19 and I couldn't go out to the bars with the boys when they were going out on the weekends, or, you know, some of the outside the field stuff was a little bit different because you're not traveling on road trips. And it's just like everybody's kind of renting places and you get a chance to go hang out with guys that are from different organizations and hear what the experiences are like with the Rays versus with the Mets versus with the Blue Jays. So again, it was a really cool experience for me. I felt like I went there and did the best I could to just go out and perform on the field and had a lot of fun playing with a huge number of guys that, again, played against them later in my career, whether it's in the minor leagues or the big leagues. And that was just something, building relationships was a really cool experience there.
After that season, when you cement yourself as a top prospect, you spent the next 2 years as the number one prospect in the Blue Jay system. You mentioned having some like conversations with Ricky Romero about that, the hype and dealing with that it wasn't pre social media, but pre like what it is now and how publicized prospects are, and you know, from them having their own Instagrams and all, you know, the highlights from when they're 14 and whatever. how loud was the noise? Like when you got to double A, like how prevalent is that in the clubhouse and you're thinking of this is what I need to be or this is what I need to live up to?
Yeah, I think it's a completely different beast now with all the social media inputs, right? That you can log on to Twitter or Facebook, or probably not Facebook now for the kids, but Instagram, Snapchat, whatever it is, and have so many people talking about you, right? And back when I was coming through, Google was kind of your source of what is everybody saying about Travis Snyder. And I got into a really poor habit, and I would encourage kids going through this process or parents, like, stay away from Googling your name. As egocentric as that sounds, it's very easy when things are going well and you can read all these articles from the nice people from Baseball America all the way through the beat reporters and whatever organization you're at. Again, it just starts to fluff up this whole ego experience of like, I really am that guy. I'm that prospect. I'm the franchise. When really it's like, no, I'm Travis Snyder. I'm however many years old, and I'm here to show up and put in the work to become a great baseball player. And I'm very far away from the end point of being a great baseball player and just staying focused on the process in that moment. And I think, you know, kids, I have a close family member who's going through this process now with the college draft, kind of where am I going to be at? What's going to be the best route for him in terms of his development? And it's like, it's really difficult to say that there's one answer to all these questions. But for me, it was really being able to not have to log on to social media every day and see, right, how cool I am. Later in my career, I think it was 2009 or 2010, hopped on Twitter, which I was reluctant to do because I just felt like the whole world of social media was kind of the wild, wild west. And then next thing I knew, I had 60,000 followers on Twitter, and I was posting mostly food and non kind of baseball stuff. So I tried to keep it light and more fun and try to get as many free meals as I could. But again, I fell victim to hopping on and scrolling through, you know, at mentions too many times in my career where it was like, man, I really am that guy. I'm that good. You know what I mean? And you're looking for that external validation instead of understanding it. No, it's an internal motivation. It's an internal process. And the more that we allow those external inputs to come in, which is like impossible now not to, if you're on social media or Googling your name, for lack of a better way of doing it, then you're really exposing yourself to all the outside noise that you asked about. Whereas I think my teammates in the organization, my coaches in the organization, everybody kind of treated me differently because of the success that I had, because I was the first round pick. And because I showed up to the field and I played hard every day, I earned a lot of respect of a lot of people throughout my career. But it also started to, again, chip away at my own sense of identity and what made me great as a player was that internal drive and that process and understanding where you got to be, where your feet are, and not thinking about the 10-year contract or the Hall of Fame induction. And those are all goals, right, you can set. But when those become the driving force in your ability to wake up every day, when the path to those goals doesn't look as clear, it makes it very difficult to stay motivated.
Growing businesses and finance professionals, you need Bill Spend and Expense, the free-to-use spend management software. It's powered by the Bill Divvy Corporate Card, which helps growing companies scale with credit lines of $500 to $15 million, automated expense reports, and as many virtual cards as you need. For a limited time, get $500 when you get started with Bill Spend and Expense. Request a demo at bill.com/get500. Terms and conditions apply. Advertised credit ranges are not guaranteed and are determined at approval. Card issued by Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Let's take a quick left turn and talk about food since you mentioned it, because, you know, as a kid, as a teenager, as a guy in my 20s, you know, oh man, being a professional baseball player would be great. The playing a game and the money and all that stuff. Now, as a guy in my 30s who likes to cook, I think about, wow, that would be a great profession to just get to eat a bunch of different stuff in a bunch of different cities. Like, did you take full advantage, especially because, like, I've heard great things about Toronto as a city, for one. Were you able to... You know, were you living on PB&J, or were you really kind of trying to expand the palate as you traveled the country?
As a young kid, I was not as well traveled as I am now in my 30s. Didn't eat at a lot of really nice steakhouses, and you know, grew up with a mom who was a fantastic cook, so I kind of knew good food. But, you know, I had my first taste of sushi in South Bend, Indiana during A-ball, which is like, why of all the places you grow up in Seattle, you're trying sushi?
Not really the sushi capital of the world, South Bend, sir. Indiana.
Yeah, and this is before I think all the shipping and stuff that's available now. So, but no, as I progressed through the minor leagues, created relationships. Ricky and I are guys that spent a lot of time going to dinner, nice dinners. We called them show dinners back in the day. You know, top end steakhouses. And that was part of my motivation for Twitter, was to get free meals. So I was able to take, I would say, full advantage, and maybe to a fault, of where, you know, going out to eat and putting on a display of eating a 40 ounce prime rib, or just kind of doing some things I think are just too extreme in that sense. But I mean, my experiences in Toronto from a culinary standpoint were next level. Pittsburgh, we had some great restaurants there. And same with Baltimore when we were there for a few months. We had a lot of really good dining experiences. And then going on the road, I think that's one of the things, if you ask retired baseball players what they miss the most, is like going to a city, getting off the plane with all your boys, heading to the reservation at one of the nicest steakhouses in the city, getting treated like you're, you know, special because you're a baseball player. And again, that goes into the ego stuff that we talk about, that you really got to be careful of what you're buying into and what you think people think of you versus who you are and what makes you great. So I took full advantage of the food stuff. I'm also a big cook, right? So when my buddies on the team, when we would come into town, I'd invite the team up to my house and had epic barbecues with, you know, ribeyes, New York's, fillets, crab, corn, whatever. Like, we just throw a big barbecue for everybody there to be able to kind of blow off some steam in a safe space. And what I love to do is surf, right, and cook for people and have the people that I care about over and do that. So I still do a lot of that now as a retired baseball player, of having my friends over and doing that. But again, the culinary aspect for me was a delightful experience throughout my career.
Man, it makes me so happy that you use this profession to the best of your ability to eat well, because that is, I mean, that speaks to my heart. So you hit double A as a 20-year-old, then you hit triple A, and then walk me through the call. You go through the most rapid of journeys to the big leagues. We're seeing it more often now, but I mean, you're up quick. You're up before your 21st birthday.
Yeah, and I've talked about it a little bit, but double A that year, I struggled, and then I really got hot, made the All-Star team, won the Home Run Derby, didn't know if triple A was on the radar. One of the vet DHs up there punched a water cooler, broke his wrist, so they said, hey, you're swinging it well, let's get you a taste of triple A, and then you'll go back to the Arizona Fall League. So I go up to triple A, and I'm in a position where I think I was hitting with runners on base almost every at bat, and had just a massive output for about three and a half weeks, kind of build off the momentum that I had created in double A. And, you know, I thought I was potentially going to get called up, and the assistant GM, who was a big part of drafting me at the time, Tony LaCava, just an outstanding human being, came in and said, hey, listen, kid, we're really proud of you. You put in a ton of great work this year. We've seen the progress, but we're not going to call you up. We want you to get ready to go back to the Fall League and then come back to AAA next year and compete for a job in the big leagues. And I said, hey, great. You know, I've done everything I can up until this point. My goal preseason, I told my agent I'm going to be in the big leagues, because I had seen the Justin Uptons and Cameron Maybens do it the year before in the draft class before me. So that was a goal of mine, but I didn't feel like I was defeated, right, when they gave me that news. And then continued to hit for the next 3 or 4 days. Tony was still in town. Our manager at the time, Doug Davis, had me in the lineup for a doubleheader in Lehigh Valley. And after the first game, I was scratched, which is kind of unusual, right? They're putting me out there. This is kind of before the workload management was a thing. So I was used to playing every single game, every single day. And at the time, I was told, "Hey, you're going to sit the second game." I'm like, "Okay, that's kind of weird," but I didn't really think much of it. I'm sitting by the hitting coach during the game, and he's talking about how the lights are brighter in the big leagues and kind of hinting like, "Hey, something's going to happen here." So then I walk in the clubhouse after the game, get pulled in the manager's office. Tony LaCava's in there, Doug Davis, Al LaBeouf. I mean, just a storybook experience for me to get that news, and I'm going to the major leagues. Unfortunately, I'd sent all my stuff home because they had told me, "Hey, you're not going to go to the big leagues." So all my stuff in Double A, I just sent back to Seattle, my car, my suits, all that stuff. And then the next morning, I'm in a town car going from Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania, into the city of New York, which again, not, at 20 years old, is pretty surreal. That night before, I'd called my buddy to book five flights for my dad, my sister, and three of my best friends to fly out for the weekend, which was in the old Yankee Stadium, which again is still one of my favorite stories to tell. As I got to play my first game in the old stadium, I got my first hit. Derek Jeter came over to congratulate me as the first person to say anything after my first hit. So, all really cool stories that I'll get to tell my grandkids someday, and my kids when they're old enough to maybe care. But at this point, I'm feeling like the manifestation of this whole egoic narrative that I'd really bought into was taking place, and felt like the sky, like I mentioned, was the limit. Even though the first series was like mixed emotions, you know, a lot of excitement, a lot of just like, "Oh man, I made it. Here I am in this big city. Now I got to get on this plane and fly with the big boys back to Toronto." It was just really cool overall experience for me. And then just living in a hotel for the rest of the season up in Toronto, it was an interesting experience, but one that I had experienced quite a few times in my career. And then going back up there to start the season in 2009 just felt like this was going to be the beginning of a long, successful career as a Toronto Blue Jay, and hopefully one that, you know, lasted for 10, 15, 20 years and would retire as a Blue Jay type of thing. And that was ultimately my goal, is I wanted to be that franchise player. But as the season started to go, I was really good in April and then really bad in May, and was dealing with some lower back inflammation. I was diagnosed with degenerative disc syndrome. Was dealing with pain from an off-season injury that hadn't quite healed, and was not able to get over the hump mentally, emotionally, and physically with what I was dealing with. But not to the point where I was on the DL. So I get sent down, and then I get injured in a collision at first base, like a week or two after being there. And when I got sent down, I was in a really bad mood. I didn't handle it at the as professionally as I would have liked to. But I also felt like I needed time and space to process, because it was like my carpet or my rug had been pulled out from underneath me. So it was a really difficult inflection point in my career that I've talked about at length, where it really kind of defined the rest of my career in a lot of negative ways, which is unfortunate, because there's a lot of people that go down to AAA in their career and come back and play for 5, 10, 15 more years. And I was able to chip away and log service time and battle my way back after kind of every demotion or designation for assignment. And then once we got through kind of the bulk of the 8 years of going up and down, it was really difficult for me when I was in spring training with Kansas City as a non-roster invite and playing the second half of spring training games. It was really tough for my ego just to say, "You know what, this is what it is, and you got to make the most of your situation." So really the next 5 years of my career was a therapeutic process in its own way, of having to make mistakes, having to allow my ego, or I allowed my ego, to kind of take the wheel as far as what I thought was right and wrong, and wanting to make excuses and blame people. And again, the only way you get back to the big leagues from AAA is by saying, "I'm here and I got to handle my business." And I did that a lot throughout my career. But as I had more experience in the big leagues and I'd created more expectations for the way things were going to go, as we all learn in life, things don't go to our expectations and to our plans, and you got to be ready to deal with that. And I think that was something I battled for all 16 years of playing, but ultimately go back to that moment in 2009 when I got sent down and just not being prepared for that, right? People ask, "Were you ready to play in the big leagues?" I think physically I was, but emotionally I was not ready for the struggle and then the send down, and then to still believe that I could be this player that my ego and everybody around me had said, "This is what I'm capable of doing."
Yeah, and sometimes you see, because like doing the show for a long time and looking just through a lot of baseball references pages because I'm a nerd, you see a lot of times when guys, not on the way back down where it's like it's kind of over for them as a potential regular, but like the up and down things, like sometimes like the AAA numbers dip because for a variety of reasons, whatever, maybe they've gotten figured out, or maybe it's just like their heart isn't in AAA. throughout your entire career, even when you're on the back half where you're, you know, you're a couple years removed from getting a shot at the big leagues, your AAA numbers are always there. Is there, with, again, with hindsight, is there a path that was there that you can see that would have maybe been a better structure for you to eventually be like a 10-year regular, you know, a guy with a regular gig? Is there, you know, is it maybe coming up on a bad team and just getting 162 games of we're not going anywhere? Or is it something that, you know, emotionally that you might not have been able to handle regardless of the circumstance?
I think the hardest thing to accept as a player is that it's not just about you and what's best for you. It's about what the organization and the people that get paid to make those decisions feel like is what's in the best interest of you, but more importantly, the organization. Depending on where you're at as an organization, are you playing to win? Are you rebuilding? I was kind of caught in between when I got called up in 2008. The GM, JP Ricciardi, I think got fired in the 2009 or going into 2010. So he was kind of at the end of his rope in terms of trying to put a winner on the field. I was mixed in with a lot of just fantastic veteran guys, but the dynamic of the clubhouse was a difficult one for a young guy to really feel like I belong there, even though the vets were always great as far as treating me and taking me places and trying to mentor me. It was just an old school vibe, and there wasn't a lot of time and space for people who struggled mentally. It was still kind of a faux pas, for lack of a better term, that just people kind of looked at you weird if you said, hey, I need help. And I struggled a lot with that, trying to live up to some of the veteran guys' expectations of me. Again, just putting way too much emphasis on what everybody's opinion was of me instead of what's my opinion of me and how do I move forward and execute the things that I know I want to do to be who I am. So getting into that position, it was really difficult to understand as a 19, 20, 21-year-old kid who I was and what made me valuable outside of just being the super prospect. And I think that's something for a lot of guys as they're going through this. Some guys handle it better than others. I mean, you look at what happened to Jackson Holliday this year. I have no idea where he's at currently. I know he struggled immensely in his call-up. It doesn't mean that he can't be a great player. And for me, it was going through those ups and downs in my career. A lot, you know, I dealt with a lot of physical injuries. I had surgery after the 2013 season, a brutal toe surgery, and then avoided a hip microfracture, just a whole issue that I had with my hip with an impingement, and was supposed to have surgery and ended up rehabbing it going into the 2015 season or 2016 season. And then being, like I mentioned, as a non-roster invite in 2016, I had a great opportunity with the Royals to play well in AAA and get called up. And I played well for about the first 2 weeks. And then my ego was triggered and I'm texting my agent, what am I doing here? Why are they not calling me up? And it's like, I went through that as a Blue Jay, where I'd call my agent and bitch to him and complain or talk to the GM and like, why am I in AAA right now? And it was all about me, right? Instead of understanding the bigger picture of what you can control and what you can't control. And I really got to a place after a couple of weeks in Omaha in 2017, which is probably the worst year statistically in terms of a triple slash. I struggled. I was taking 300-400 swings a day in the cage. I had no trust in what I was doing once I struggled for a week or two there and tried to reinvent the whole wheel. And for me, it was just a battle with my ego for that entire 2016 season with the Royals of there is this opportunity there, but I'm not taking advantage of it. And a lot of it was driven by my ego saying, you know, this is this person's fault and I should have been here, instead of like, no, I need to handle my business every single day and be where my feet are, as Clint Hurdle would say. So in that experience, I really struggled. I got released around the trade deadline and was searching for a job. And at that point, I was unable to land an opportunity to go finish out that season. So I went into the offseason kind of humbled and really trying to figure out who I am and what I wanted to do. I ended up signing with the Texas Rangers going into the next year and made a promise to myself and made a deal with some of the guys on that team that were vets of the major leagues that we're going to be going through the same mental hurdles and traps that we set for ourselves by making excuses and blaming other people, and really focused on just handling my attitude every single day and showing up to grind and just get better. And I think statistically speaking, I had a solid year that year. My power numbers were down. I was kind of in between this whole idea of swinging up, swinging down, instead of what made me a great hitter, right? And all the the routines that I had early in my career. I'd gone through so many routines and so many swing changes at this point. It was really tough for me to commit to hitting for power and allowing that average to kind of dip down. And that's something that I never really overcame during that season. I think I hit close to 300 and ended up getting traded to the Mets later in the season, right around the September call-ups. You know, I was playing well after I got traded with the Mets. A lot of guys were getting injured and traded, and was supposed to be a call-up at that time, and found out kind of through an internal source that I was going up. And then the day that call-ups were happening, they ended up claiming a guy who had just been put on waivers by another major league organization. So my spot was no longer there. And there was that expectation, okay, I'm back. I'm you know, all the grinding I've gone through these last couple of years, I'm finally getting back to the big leagues. And that carpet was pulled right out from under me as well. And that, again, that triggered a big response for me. I tweeted about this, I think about a year ago, where I called my agent and I'm just, you know, screaming at him. And finally, he just said, you know, told me to shut the F up and just laid into me. And he's like, listen, you made a deal before the season that you weren't going to be this guy. And right now you are that guy. And I wanted to pack my bag and go home. And he said, stick it out and be a man and be a professional and handle this thing the right way. And I'm extremely grateful for Joe Urban from CAA Sports who laid into me at that point in my career, because it was the reality check that I needed. And then went into that season really hungry, really motivated, like I was this close, I could taste it. And they took it away from me, and I'm not going to let them do that again. And then that was kind of the offseason of free agency that was really weird for veteran tweener roster, non-roster guys like me. I went down to the Players Association's spring training, which was, you know, they did the best they could to provide us with opportunities to stay in shape and also get a job. And I wasn't able to get a job going out of that. So fly back home, I'm interviewing with some radio stations thinking, you know, what am I going to do now that baseball is done? Decided that my wife and I decided that we were going to go to play for the Long Island Ducks, which is the independent league up there in the Atlantic League.
The legendary Long Island Ducks.
Legendary.
It's like big leaguer camp.
They're the Yankees, and I think the Somerset's now an affiliate, but yeah, it was like the New York Yankees of any ball, right? So I fly out there. I got a 2-year-old son, my wife, and we're trying to figure out how to make this experience as enjoyable as possible, but really focus on the business of wanting to get back to affiliated ball and feeling like I was so close to the big leagues the year before. And then going into the next season, I can't even get a minor league job, right? Not even an invite to minor league camp. So there I am, humbled again, grinding through it. Took me a couple weeks to get over the mental hurdle of making excuses and saying I'm going to retire every time I rolled over to second base. Just kind of in a tough mindset, and then was able to really just embrace it and played really well for about three and a half months. At the time, my brother-in-law had been diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma and had multiple brain tumors and had a 2-year-old son and my sister he was married to. I was talking to on a regular basis. It was really stressful time, but I was able to separate that and still go out and perform on the field. But with the idea like, hey, if I don't get picked up by week after the trade deadline, there's not really a chance I'm going to get picked up. So at that point, I didn't get picked up. I made the decision to go home and be with my family and help my sister and my brother-in-law through his last couple of months of life. And it was really profound experience for me, having gone through quite a bit of death and sickness early in my life, and then revisiting all that with somebody who was like a brother to me. It was difficult, but it also kind of spurred a new motivation and an energy in me to say, you know what, if I can watch a 35-year-old, 36-year-old man die on a bed with his whole life that he didn't get to go out and achieve the things that he do, I need to stop making excuses and give this thing one more shot. So going into 2019 with the Diamondbacks, signed a straight minor league deal, no big league camp, showed up there humble, hungry, grinded my way through spring training, performed very well, was in a really good place mentally. Then they told me going into it, we don't have a spot for you. And they told me 3 days before spring training, we don't have a spot for you. We're going to send you to AA and put you on the Phantom. I said, let me stay in Arizona and just stay in shape. And then I'll go right to AA when a spot opens. 2 days later, 3 guys get hurt and I'm going to AAA, and not sure how long I'll be in AAA, but I had to kind of make this decision. My wife was pregnant with our second child at the time. I just tweeted about this 2 days ago on his birthday. And it was like, man, I'm living away from my family, my almost three-year-old son at the time, my wife, and she's pregnant, seven months pregnant. And I'm in Reno just like, okay, I'm all in. Like, this is, there's no excuses. There's nothing I can do at this point to take away from the goal of reaching the big league. So I went out and hit 400 in April after starting the first game on the Phantom DL and thinking, okay, we're back, right? We're putting up the numbers. Organization's noticing. I'm having really good, you know, conversations with them. played through, I think it was June, July. Still had really solid numbers across the board. You know, a fringe conversational call-up guy. Not saying they ever promised that, but I felt like I was putting my name in the conversation. And then I broke my thumb. And it was like August. Rehab for 5 or 6 weeks. Just realized when I started swinging again, there was no way I was going to be able to make contact without just severe pain. So I had to shut it down and went home. Spent a couple weeks with the team and then went back to be with my wife and my newborn son. And then was going into the 2020 season, getting an invite to Major League Camp with the D-backs, right? And it's like, okay, this is the step back to where we want to go. And I did not realize how emotionally triggering that was for me going back to Major League Camp after the long journey of being away from it. I just didn't really feel like I fit in, even though I had been there and played, you know, X amount of games and been around for X amount of years. It was just a weird experience where I didn't go in mentally and emotionally in the same place I did the year before. COVID happened. I ended up getting released about a month and a half after because there was no minor league season. I wasn't going to spring training 2.0. So it was like, here we are again. Don't really know what's going to happen. Am I done playing? We waited for 3 or 4 weeks as everything was kind of getting figured out. Didn't get any invites. I tried to stay in shape. I was just losing the motivation with no real like carrot at the end of the stick. We took a family vacation down to Mexico where my wife's from. And then sure enough, 2 days into the trip, I get a call from my agent. He's like, hey, you want to go to the Marlins camp? I'm like, yeah, sure. So I go to the Marlins camp, fly out with nothing. I got everything shipped in, bunch of stuff got lost. It was just a whole show. And then great people there, jumped into it, was in pretty good shape, but just never really found the rhythm with the bat at the plate. It was right around the time the whole team got COVID. So like there was opportunities for me to go up if I had played better. And I didn't. And that was something that when they released me at the end of the, I think it was end August, early September, it was like, hey, you know, we gave you a shot. We appreciate what you brought here, but we're going to move in a different direction. Okay, great. I'm flying back to Mexico to meet my family and then fly back home. And then, yeah, going into 2020, that offseason, my father passed away. I started working with Seth, and that's kind of come full circle on this long-winded story of my career. That's when I started doing the work. That's when I started to realize, okay, there's a lot of deep stuff that as a 32-ish-year-old man at the time with two kids and a third one on the way, I really got to start diving into my own stuff, right? If I want to be a better parent, if I want to be a better coach, eventually I want to be a better husband. These were all things that were affecting me on a daily basis. So throughout that 21 season, had a lot of great experiences, got to play with some awesome, awesome guys and play for one of my good buddies, Matt Tuiasosopo, who's now the third base coach for the Braves and a local Washington boy who went through a lot of these same things in his career, right?
Legendary Washington family.
Yes, for sure. So again, it was kind of a cool but bittersweet ending to my career. Called the organization about 2 weeks before the season was over. Alex Anthopoulos, my old GM from Toronto, and said, Alex, I appreciate the opportunity, but I need to go home and I need to be with my family and I need to go through my own process of unpacking this whole 16 years of ups and downs and back into my childhood stuff. And they just say, we appreciate what you did. And kept the door open for further conversations. But at that time, I just didn't have the juice. I didn't have the drive. And I got a 7-year-old son who keeps asking me, Dad, why'd you retire? Why'd you retire? I'm like, dude, it was time. Like, there's a million excuses I could give you as to why, but ultimately it was my time.
Before we wrap, I want to talk about the term bust, because the Athletic article we mentioned a few times in the title, the word bust is in there. Baseball is very unique in that it's a sport where you can have elite success at the professional level, and it deems you more of a bust because of where that success happened. Before I get your thoughts on it, your draft, the 2006 draft, two players drafted ahead of you didn't make it to the show. You have a higher career baseball BWAR than the number one, number two, number four, and number 13 overall pick. You have a higher career WAR of every hitter drafted behind you combined in the first round and supplemental first round. Do you know how far you have to go down in the draft after you were drafted to find a hitter with a higher WAR than you?
I have no idea. No, I haven't dove that deep.
74, John Jay. So 60 picks after you.
My guy, too, John Jay.
Do you know where you rank in career WAR in the first round and first supplemental round of your draft?
No idea.
14th, right where you were drafted.
All right.
With all that being said, what does the term bust mean to you? Because a lot of the guys in that draft or who are drafted high in baseball who go out to low A and are, you know, whatever and fall off the top prospect list and go on to careers in real estate or finance or what have you, we don't really hear about them. It's the guys who are either the top three picks of a draft or the guys like you who light it up all the way through AAA and then it just something doesn't click in the big leagues. What, you know, how do you feel about that word?
When I first started working with Seth, and he's got a quote in there, and Brittany chose the title, that rubbed some people the wrong way. And I had a lot of people reach out and support, like, dude, you're not a bust. You're not a bust. I'm like, listen, there was a point in time where I believed that I was a bust. And the term bust is my own expectations and then the external expectations that I started to really listen to. I did not achieve what I think I was capable of doing physically in the major leagues. That being said, a lot of my therapeutic process has been unpacking all of those things and coming, you know, to a peace with why things happened the way they did, how I can learn from those things, not only for my own personal growth, right, but to help mentor other people that are going through this process. To me, it became more of this is what was supposed to happen for me, right? Whatever your beliefs are, I think that we have concepts and ideas and expectations of how our life's going to go. And then the world or the universe or the religion that you believe in guides you to a place where it's not what you expected. Right. And I think that for me was such a profound journey to finally reach a point where I didn't look at my career and have the shame or have that label of being a bust. Now, Brittany chose that title for the article, which I completely understand because A, in the world of sports writers, to your point, that could be construed as a bust. But I know my stats are average, right? My career length is average compared to Major League Baseball players who is like there's 20 something thousand of us. So to get people to click on the article, MLB bust is going to be a much better headline than a former Major League Baseball player, right? And then my average
guy who got like half pension.
Yeah, right. And then my partner had a quote in there, which he felt really bad after he read it. He's like, dude, I said that your career was a complete and utter failure. I'm like, when I started working with you, that's what I thought. That's what we talked about, right? So to me, it's not a personal dig if somebody wants to call me a bust. I know what I did in my career. I know where things went well. I know where things didn't go well. But for me to live a healthy, happy, fruitful life from 33 on until I die, if I'm going to sit there and look in the rearview mirror and have all these regrets about my career instead of learning and understanding from those experiences, I'm going to be a miserable person, right? And that was what I was dealing with throughout my career. And part of the reason why I decided to retire is because I realized how much of myself was lost in the game of baseball. And it's rediscovering all those things about myself, my personality, my ability to influence people, my platform as a former player, all these things that can be utilized to share my story, right? Which if we title it Bust, we're going to get more clicks. Now we're in a position to share these stories and use this platform to help educate parents, coaches, players on what kids are really going through and help parents understand what are they going through while they're watching their kids struggle or have all kinds of success at certain levels of youth sports. And that really was a big motivational factor for me in starting 3A Athletics and partnering with Seth in this process is like, he's got a completely different viewpoint on why people struggle and has a way of helping people really get to the root causes of those things. But ultimately we want to be able to do this at scale and we want kids and we want parents and coaches to have an awareness, right? Step one is creating the awareness and step two is really solving these problems. To really use my platform and my story to help parents understand the humanization of the sports experience. Because everything just becomes about your statistics or your rankings. And it's like, no, that's a human being. That's a little kid who's 15 years old, 16 years old, that has all these things being projected on them through social media and through the circles and the energy fields that they're plugged into. And I think that's something, you know, my cautionary tale for parents and for athletes and coaches is like, understand the game you're playing and learn how to play the game and don't let the game play you. That's a famous Tupac Shakur quote. That was my senior quote in high school.
That's a good one. I got a quick rapid fire for you. Then I'll let you get out of here.
Cool.
Favorite minor league ballpark?
New Hampshire.
Best pitcher you ever faced?
Roldis Chapman early out of the bullpen.
Oof. Underrated big league food city.
Milwaukee.
Ooh. Do you have a Lou Ford story from your season in Long Island?
Oh, baby, I got a million Lou Ford stories. I think
Lou Ford is one of my white whales, man.
He is the father time. Yeah, I just think when you see he was 42-ish at the time. Just a ball player, not into all the fancy trainings and things. Just a grinder who shows up to the field every day, loves being around the guys, and can hit. I mean, the guy would be a coach for a month and then a player for a month, and he'd come out and hit 300, be hitting in the middle of the lineup like he never missed a beat. So I think he is the father time of the world of the Atlantic Baseball League and just professional baseball as a whole.
You are a cold plunge guy. Pitch people on the cold plunge.
For me, there's mental and emotional benefits, and starting with doing something you don't want to do. And I think that's maybe overused in the world of like promoting these types of things. But I do truly believe that if you force yourself to do things that you know are good for you, but you don't want to do them, that there's a cascade effect that makes decisions later in the day easier to make that might have been harder if you wouldn't have done that first thing in the morning. And I still struggle, right, with that inner B. I use that term, the voice in your head that says, no, you don't need this, just be comfortable and blah, blah, blah. And I think the more that you learn to push against that thing in a healthy way, it can lead to a lot of self-growth and an opportunity to find physical as well as mental benefits from doing the cold plunge.
Last question, everyone gets this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Yeah, it was Long Island. We were coming back from Southern Maryland. Again, I'm 29, 30-ish years old, played in the major leagues, got a wife, got a kid, sitting in traffic, New York City, back of the bus, music's blasting, it's 4 in the morning, we're still about 3 hours from getting to the island, and I'm just looking at the boys, I'm like, I don't think I can do another one of these. Like, I've hit my breaking point. I've been on 14-hour bus trips, I've been on overnighters, I've made a lot of poor choices in terms of recovery and just being prepared for the next day, and this is at the top of the list for me with the worst bus trips.
Everyone right away. Sometimes people struggle to answer a question. I've got the bus ride is instant. Everyone has that one.
Again, it's like minor leagues versus big leagues. It's, you know, we can find excuses, and I think those are the ones that really stick with us. They're just like, how can I continue to do something like this? This is just too much.
Well, Travis Snyder, that is all I've got for you. I encourage everyone to go check out what you're doing with 3A. Thank you so much for joining from Phenom the Farm.
Yeah, check us out, www.3athletics.com, and sign up for our mailing list. We'd love to have as many parents and youth sports join our mission of trying to impact the culture in a positive way to help parents understand, players understand, and coaches understand how beautiful the world of sports can be, but the dangers and the risks that we take by putting our kids out there every day.
Man, that's awesome stuff. That speaks to my heart. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You got it.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.